Lecture 5, Isabella and Ferdinand, An Age of Reform.
Welcome to Lecture 5. In Lecture 4, we look at the first reforms of Isabella and Ferdinand and how they came to power in 1474. In Lecture 5, we will continue to look at some of the reforms of Ferdinand and Isabella, setting the stage for the events of 1492. Once they took power in 1474, as I said to you in Lecture 4, they began a series of reforms. The first one was to reestablish order, and they did so by, in a sense, taming the nobility and by making the nobility enter into a contract with the monarchy, in which the nobility will become the faithful servants of the crown in return for the preservation of the status, for the social and economic status. But the reforms were not just limited to the restoration of order. Beginning in 1476, in the Cortes of Madrigal, which are among the best and most important of the Cortes held in Castile, and I want to emphasize once again that these reforms are really taking place only in Castile, and that nothing at all is taking place in the Crown of Aragon, which is left to its ancient liberties and to its ancient customs and practices. But in Castile, the Catholic kings, borrowing from many medieval precedents, and again I want to emphasize this as well, that the reforms of the Catholic monarchs are not really new. They borrow from previous precedents, except that they are now really implemented in ways in which they could not be implemented before. The first important reform of the Catholic monarchs after the restoration of order is to set the economy aright. And this comes in two different ways. One is by establishing new taxes. These new taxes are essentially concentrated in two areas. One is the movement of livestock throughout the country, the transhumans, and the transhumans was most important in Castile. This is the annual movement of flocks of livestock that went from northern pastures to southern pastures, from winter to summer pastures, and you tax the livestock as it moves throughout the peninsula, and then by the exportation of wool to Flanders. This has important consequences. One, it provides the monarchy with a steady source of income. But two, it sets the economy of Castile into a very specific path. It is an economy which now depends mostly on the exportation of raw material, of wool. It links Castile and therefore Spain to northern markets, specifically to Flanders. And as we are going to see in a later lecture, there will be also a political connection with Flanders as well. And three, it freed the Catholic monarchs from the subsidies of Parliament. They will still go to Parliament to get taxes. They will still go to the Cortes to get subsidies, but nonetheless, they now have a secure and a steady source of income. More importantly, however, the dependence on the transhumans and on the exportation of wool and on agriculture, in a sense, solidify the economic and social structures of Castile and therefore of Spain, because it privileged the certain type of economic structures, that is to say, landed estates, transhuman, livestock, and so on. That is to say, it privileges the kind of economic structures that supports the nobility and the clergy. And Spain, therefore, from 1470s onward, from 1492 onwards, enters into a kind of path, economic path, which will eventually lead to the destruction of Spain. Let me explain what I mean by this. While in Europe, we are almost on the verge of the development of capitalism and large-scale trade and commercial enterprises and manufacturing, the Spanish economy reverts to an agrarian model, which is based upon an aristocratic concept of life. This is not to say that there are not merchants in Spain. Many historians have talked about the treason of the bourgeoisie, how the bourgeoisie engages in purchasing lands and becomes essentially the kinds of landowners and abandon the commercial enterprises. This is not true. In fact, there is a very lively commercial culture in Castile and certainly in the Crown of Aragon, specifically in places like Barcelona and Valencia. But they are not first. What is first is an economy which is based upon an agrarian base and which favors essentially the clergy and the nobility. This is part of the arrangement, this is part of the quid pro quo that has been worked out between the aristocracy and the crown. We support your economic aspirations, you support us in our political aims. Essentially what I'm trying to say here is that this is a very conservative kind of economic structure, and that in fact a great number of the institutions that are going to be created, and I will argue the Inquisition among them, are really aimed at keeping in line those people who want to transform the economy of Spain. So on the one hand, the Catholic monarchs find a steady source of income. They set a course for the economy of Spain, which is very successful in the late 15th century, but which would be a total failure by the 16th and 17th century. On the other hand, the Catholic monarchs also recover a great deal of the lands that have been alienated to the high nobility. The high nobility has to give back a great deal of what they have taken from the crown throughout the 15th century, including the military orders, so that by 1492, the Ferdinand the Catholic is the master of all the military orders with access to the incredible wealth that the military orders hold. So in some respects, by the end of the 15th century, the Catholic monarchs have been able to essentially take hold of the economy and have important sources of income to, in fact, invest in specific plans. One of them, of course, will be the attack against Granada. The other one will be international affairs, the interventions in Italy, in North Africa, and, of course, the enterprise of the Americas. So the first reform is a reform of the economy. The second reform, I think a very important one, is the reform of the church and of culture. When the Catholic monarchs come to power in 1474, Ferdinand in Aragon in 1479, the Catholic Church, the church in Spain, was, as was the church elsewhere in the West, extraordinarily corrupt. The priests were badly educated. They did not follow, follow the vows of chastity or obedience. They were incredibly corrupt, and they were completely enmeshed in the politics of the realm. This will stop. Isabella, above all, was very interested in a reformed church. And with a very iron hand, she, in fact, cleaned the church. Why is this important? This is important because by the end of the 15th century, the Spanish church is the only reformed church in Western Christendom. Therefore, when the Reformation comes in the early 16th century, the Spanish church is going to play, not only because it has a political power behind it, but it also because it has a moral authority to assume a position of leadership within the church itself. So in many respects, what we're really talking about here is an extraordinary transformation within the way in which the church is organized, the manner in which the church is, in a sense, projected to the outside world, in which there is a new kind of piety and spirituality. We are going to see how some of these sentiments, how some of these feelings are reflected in the literary works of the late 15th century, which we will examine in Lecture 6. But for the present, I would like to point out to you that the Catholic monarchs speak to the people from a position of moral authority, because not only are they engaged in the restoration of political order, they are also engaged in the restoration of a spiritual and moral order within the kingdom itself. Then, of course, culture. I think that one of the things that I want to do in Lecture 6 is to speak about the extraordinary transformation in the culture of the age. And it's a culture that, in a sense, blossoms in the late 15th century with the restoration of order. It had antecedents that went back to the period before the Catholic monarchs, but it takes off at the end of the 15th century. And it is first and foremost, in fact, shall we say, organized around university training. One of the things that the Catholic monarchs do is to create an extraordinary vast bureaucracy. And I will talk about this a bit later on. This bureaucracy is run mostly by people who are university trained. They are called in Spanish the letrados. And I will speak about them in Lecture 6 in greater detail. These letrados, strangely enough, the majority of them come from the middling sorts. They are new people. Most of them are conversos. This is said, that's to say, they are Jews who have converted to Christianity in 1391, the descendants of them. And they are people who owe their allegiances to the crowns. A bureaucracy, especially a university-trained bureaucracy, is very important in the business of ruling and power. Because what we are really talking about here is a tremendous concentration not only in university training, universities that will produce the bureaucrats who will run the government in ways which are completely new and different altogether from the old kind of lax medieval ways, but people who are also completely loyal to the crown because they owe their positions and their prosperity to the fact that they are the employees, the servants of the crown, no longer the nobility serving in a very different relationship to the crown, but people who serve the crown in lovely positions or in high ones and who can rise to the ground through the ranks of the bureaucracy and who could in fact even enter the nobility and gain great prestige and great wealth by their service to the crown. So that there is a vast educational reforms, the universities are set, new colleges are created in the university with benefits to, in a sense, train these people. There is printing, I will talk about that later on in Lecture 6. There is an effervescence of culture that goes on. And this is somewhat related to the new relationship that emerges. So, economy, church, culture. And then, of course, the relationship between the crown and the towns. Now, if you remember from Lecture 4, the towns and the town militias have been exceedingly important in a sense, supporting the Catholic monarchs against the high aristocracy. They have played a unique role in supporting the king and the queen in their struggle against the nobility. These towns, of course, were caught in a very difficult situation. The towns were dominated by oligarchies. The towns were dominated by a small elite at the top. These elites consisted of two different kinds of people. In Castile, these elites were mostly the old town elites, the old military elites, commercial elites, or land-owning elites that, in a sense, ran the towns, form and organize into lineages, some of the developments that I spoke about in Lecture 3, these lineages that date back to the 13th century and that retain a great deal of power within the towns. In Ávila, the lineage of the Dávilas, and so on. To give an example, in Soria, 12 lineages run the town. They have now been joined in the 15th century, by converso elites. And they share in the business of running the towns. And they support the crown. They have supported the crown for the last 250 years, because essentially the king was a protector of the commercial enterprises, of the liberties, of their commercial activities, of the wealth, against a rapacious and selfish nobility. But it's very obvious that an arrangement is going to be worked out here between the crown and these municipal oligarchies or municipal elites. That the kings, that is to say that the crown, that Isabella and Ferdinand, are not going to allow at all the idea that the cities could have any sense of independence or autonomy. If the nobility has no autonomy, the cities will have no autonomy at all. So they do this in several ways. First, the king and queen, Isabella and Ferdinand. Remember, this is a Castilian affair, and this does not happen in Aragon. They begin to send royal officials into the towns. They are called corregidores. And these corregidores, whom we will find as well in the New World in the 16th century, are really royal representatives They are royal representatives who run the town. How is this done, and how would the municipal elites allow this to happen? Well, to begin with, the municipal elites are often the people who are named as corregidores. They rule the town the same way in which they have run the town for the last 200 years. But they do so now, no longer as, shall we say, representatives of the body, of the community, of the body politics in the town, but they do so now as representatives of the Queen, of Isabella, of the ruler of Castile. Therefore, by the 1480s, the king and queen have now access to the financial resources of the city, to the financial resources of all the towns in Castile, but also to the military, to the militias, to the military forces, and in fact command now a great power. They do not have to depend on the nobility. They have now control both of the nobility and of the towns as well. They also reduce the number of cities that are represented in parliament. And this is very important, because before you have to deal with 34 cities which send representatives to parliament, to the Cortes. The queen had to come to parliament, to the Cortes, and have to ask these 34 cities, all of which send between 8 and 2 representatives, for their permission to collect certain taxes, or they have to ask these representatives for subsidies. They now reduce the number of cities represented in the Cortes to a very small number, fluctuating between 16 and 8, depending on when we speak about. It is very easy to control such a small number of representatives to put them in your pocket. We could say that in many respects, with some exceptions, and we shall see some of the exceptions later on in lecture 12, in fact, with some exceptions, the Cortes of Castile, which are the first parliaments in Europe, in Western Europe, they have a history dating back to the late 12th century. These are the first representative assemblies in Western Europe. By the end of the 15th century, they have become a rubber stamp body. They will play very little role in the affairs of government. They will be called to session very seldom, and they will in fact play a very minor, only a kind of ceremonial and formulaic role in the affairs of Castile. This is not the case in the Crown of Aragon, where the kings still have to go hand in hand to ask for permission for certain things. Please understand that what we're really talking about here is the development of a new monster. Max Weber, a great Swiss sociologist, one of the greatest intellectuals of the last century or late in the previous century, wrote describing this phenomenon not only in Castile but in France and in England as the rise of the nation state, as the monopoly of legalized violence. In the late 15th century, as we move to 1492, what we have here is essentially the rise of the nation state. This is a very different phenomenon altogether from the earlier feudal monarchies or from the kinds of political entities that existed in the ancient world. We have a rise of a nation state, a place which has an identity, a communal identity, a national identity, a place that is united by language, by customs, by traditions, which is now centralized, and where the crown, the queen, has now appropriated for herself all the instruments of violence. The violence, the official violence, has now become within Castile essentially legalized. I cannot even begin to explain to you the importance of this. And I was talking to you in lecture 4 as I was concluding this, the kind of political capital that this will give the Catholic monarchs. Because essentially, the kind of world in Castile where violence was prevalent, where violence was pervasive, where nobles attacked peasants, will now come to an end. Because the crown calls for itself only, the only right to, in a sense, judge, try, and execute criminals. It monopolizes violence and it legalizes it. It makes it into an instrument of the state. This is what we call the new monarchies. The new monarchies that eventually grow in places like Castile, in England, in France, although in France it will come a bit later, and which essentially wield power in ways in which have not been wielded before. This is the beginnings of what a recent book, a great book by Monod entitled The Power of Kings, called The Rise and Makings of the Rational State. That is to say, a state, a nation state, and this is a very important linking of government and identity and political identity, in which the rational state rules no longer following some sacred rules or some Christian aims, or even though they will still very much pay lip service to this end, and very much even though Isabella is truly a devout Christian. What we are really talking about here, the emergence of a Machiavellian state. And it's not a coincidence that the prince is written just a few years, in 1513, Niccolo Machiavelli writes the prince, because essentially what we are talking about here is the sheer amorality of the state, the survival of the state becomes the highest law. And you use a series of instruments to rule and govern the state. So, in this order, the Catholic monarchs also create a series of councils of state. Again, this is all only a Castilian affair. You create a council of state. That is to say, you create a bureaucracy on top of the bureaucracy. The monarchs now create councils for the Hermandad. There is a council for the Santa Hermandad. There is a council for the Indies after 1492, when the Indies, that is to say, when America is discovered. There is a council for the Inquisition. So every aspect of government within Castile acquires a kind of overheading administrative council, which reports directly to the monarchs, which is in fact tied and linked directly to the direct rule of the Catholic monarchs. So in that sense, by 1492, Castile is an exceedingly well-organized, perhaps less well-organized than we thought once. We are revising this. I mean, I don't want to overemphasize this because, in fact, government remains very chaotic. But it is essentially a fairly well-organized entity in which the Catholic monarchs have total and complete control within the boundaries of Castile, a place where the subjects now recognize the lines of authority. In that respect, the founding of the Inquisition, about which I will have to say a great deal later on when I talk about conversos and Jews, is very reflective of the new ways in which Castilians think of power and in which the Catholic monarchs exercise this power. The Inquisition, as you know, dates from the 13th century. It really came into being for the first time in Languedoc to deal with Cathars, a form of heresy in the early 13th century, late 12th and early 13th century. After the Cathars were defeated in a war, there is the creation of something called the Papal or Diocesan Inquisition. And I will discuss this in another lecture that I'm doing for the Teaching Company entitled The Terror of History. In detail, the Castilian kings throughout the Middle Ages never allow the Inquisition to come into the kingdom because they rightly thought that they did not want the interference or an ecclesiastical body into the political affairs of the kingdom. The Inquisition was accepted in Aragon and functioned in Aragon, in the crown of Aragon. It functioned in England, it functioned in France, but it never functioned in Castile. Until the 1480s. And in the 1480s, the Inquisition is created, and the Inquisition is created for a very specific purpose. And I will talk about that in a future lecture. The Inquisition is created to deal with the problem of conversos. That is, the Jews who have converted to Christianity and who were thought to still be practicing some form of Judaism. Nonetheless, in the 1480s, the Inquisition comes But the Inquisition comes to Castile as a very different type of Inquisition. It is not the Papal Inquisition. It is not the Diocesan Inquisition. It is the Spanish Inquisition. Meaning by this, it's an Inquisition which is directly under the control of the Crown. Specifically, directly under the control of the Castilian Crown. And therefore, the Inquisition was in 1480s, in the 1490s, and into the 18th century, the only institution that was truly national. And it was not lost on the Aragonese that the Inquisition was yet another method to, in a sense, reach into the crown of Aragon and exert Castilian authority. And when the Inquisition came into being in the 1484, officially in 1484, you will see and you could read in the documents of the period the extraordinary resistance which the Inquisition found in the crown of Aragon, in towns like Zaragoza and Teruel and others. People and the people in those towns, especially the ruling elites in those towns, saw the Inquisition as a way in which the crown of Castile could reach out beyond its border and interfere into the affairs of their own countries. In fact, they were right, because how does the Inquisition work? The Inquisition was yet another instrument of power. I have argued in writing that the Inquisition is also a way to monitor the social and economic transformations of the kingdom. And I have argued that a great deal of the persecutions of the Inquisition have a social edge to it. That is to say, that we will persecute you if you are essentially pushing for programs that will transform the social and economic structure of the realm. That it had to do with religion on the one hand, but that it also was a form of social and economic control. I could give you an example of how the Inquisition reaches out into other kingdoms. In the 16th century, Philip II's secretary, a man named Antonio López, betrays the king and flees to Aragon, and the king has no jurisdiction over him. He puts himself under the jurisdiction of the Justicia of Aragon, and there, essentially, the king, Philip II, the most powerful king in the world, cannot reach him unless he does so by way of the Inquisition. And what he does, he accuses him of the usual charges, heresy, sodomy, and things like that, and blasphemy. And then he has the inquisitorial authorities go and get this man and try to capture him and bring him to trial. And of course, it led to a full-fledged rebellion in Zaragoza and in the crown of Aragon. But it is a way in which you can see the manner in which the Inquisition could be used for political purposes, for that purpose of controlling. The final and most important in terms of the broader politics of Europe was the reform of the army. One of the things that the Catholic monarchs did right by 1480 was to, in a sense, begin again the campaigns against Granada. As we shall see in Lecture 7, the campaign against Granada was a very difficult one because Granada is encircled by mountains. And the way in which you can take Granada was essentially by reorganizing the army. And the architect in the reorganization of the Castilian army was the great captain, Gonzalo Fernández de Córdoba, who introduced a new techniques and new organization of the army. The armies are organized into tercios. This is the name that it is. It's mostly composed of infantry. And infantry, and this borrow from the Swiss, this is an infantry which is essentially manned by aristocrats. That is to say, the Spanish army consists of lower aristocrats, the people we call hidalgos, the lower level of the nobility, who fight on foot with combinations of pikes and arquebuses, and who are incredibly well organized, tightly disciplined. These are the armies that are going to conquer the New World, and who, in fact, will eventually capture Granada and will eventually become the greatest army in Europe for the next 150 years, an army that will not be defeated in pitched battle until 1643 and that will bring terror through the entire European continent and will lead to the hegemony of Spain in Europe for the next 150 years. The consequences of these reforms this emphasis in Castile, of course, is the decline of the Crown of Aragon, the neglect of the Crown of Aragon, and the imposition of Castilian authority, practices, institutions in the New World, which was a Castilian possession, not a Spanish possession, and of course, the fact that Aragon will enjoy this neglect, but Aragon will contribute nothing to the monarchy. It will feel frozen out from the entire process of Spanish imperialism and Spanish hegemony, but it will not contribute anything to it. It will only be a source of troubles, a source of rebellions, violence, and so on. And so, this is part of the result of these reforms. In the next lecture, we will turn to culture. Thank you.